It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, it's Wisconsin Life with a look at organic farming in the Oneida community. But first, Wisconsin's Government Accountability Board has found nearly 4,000 examples of accessibility issues in Wisconsin polling places over the past 7 election cycles. Joining us to talk about that issue and what needs to be remedied in the run-up to the 2016 presidential election is Kit Kirstensteiner. She's an attorney with the Disability Rights Wisconsin, where she heads up their Help America Vote Act project. Kit Kirstensteiner, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So when we talk about accessibility in polling places, what issues are we talking about?
Oh, there's a broad range. We're talking about everything from a pile of snow in the disabled parking spot in front of the polling place to accessibility of the materials for someone who has problems reading or anything in between.
What about issues of privacy?
That is often a problem, especially if they have one touchscreen made accessible for people in a wheelchair or whatever else. Often they don't think about the privacy issue, and they'll just have it out in the open and not have the same degree of secrecy of the ballot that they will for everyone else.
Now, the GAB said that it found nearly 4,000 examples of accessibility problems over the past 7 election cycles, and they involved over 800 polling sites. Did that number surprise you in any way?
No, not when you're looking at the range of things that are problematic. I mean, some are as simple as signage, which are easily fixed, but it counts as an episode or instance, and some are really troubling. But I think there's been an attempt by the county clerks to work on the issues over time, and hopefully it'll keep getting better.
Have you heard from people that you work with that they may have experienced problems like these?
Yes, we have a disability voting hotline that we have every year during the election, anytime there's an election around the state. And we get a few calls here and there, and some after the fact, about people who experienced problems, usually with their wheelchair wouldn't go through the opening, or there were steps. Sometimes I've heard recently about some individuals who were there to help individuals with some sort of cognitive impairment to help them vote, and they were told, no, you can't come in. No one can help them vote, which is not the case.
So what happens?
They can't give them ideas about who to vote for, but they can help them with the process of
voting.
Sure.
And what happens, do you think, when a person, say, does show up and encounters an issue that has to do with accessibility? Do they go ahead and vote, or do you think that issues like this actually suppress the number of votes, maybe?
There can be a chilling effect, and people. Not so much that people show up and are unable to vote. There should also be curbside voting for individuals who have mobility issues, and it's not, say, there are stairs or the doorway is too small. There is the ability to vote curbside. I think what happens more often is that people think, "Oh boy, this is just going to be too much of a hassle. I know that building over on the other side of town, and I got to negotiate this, and I don't know where to park." And I think that just that, before they even go out the door, probably can have some effect on people voting.
So tell me a little bit more about curbside voting. Is that something that is in effect in Wisconsin?
Absolutely, and has been. If you have a problem with some of these places that have these 4,000 incidents of accessibility issues, not all of them will relate to this, but if you do have an issue or just have, even if it is accessible, even if there is everything is fine, it's one level and everything's wide enough, if you have problems getting out of your vehicle, you can ask to do curbside voting. And a registrar election official will bring it out, let you vote, take it back in, and run it through the machine.
Is the photo ID requirement, as you see it, an aspect of accessibility?
Yeah. We're trying to get people motivated. I know it's August and the weather's beautiful, but the primaries in the in the next year are just around the corner, and some of the issues for, especially for people with disabilities, are not that easily dealt with in terms of getting a proper ID. A lot of folks with disabilities don't drive. A lot of them don't have someone who can take them over to Department of Motor Vehicles, and then they don't have one, two, or three of the things they need, so they have to come back again. And it's a very, they don't have a lease, they don't have a cell phone. There are all sorts of situations that contribute to the difficulty in coming up with a photo ID that's accessible or that is appropriate for the polling places.
We're talking right now with Kit Kirschensteiner. She's an attorney with Disability Rights Wisconsin, where she heads their Help America Vote Act project, talking about findings of accessibility issues in 4,000 issues here in Wisconsin at 800 polling places. So, Kit, whose job is it to make sure that places are compliant and accessible for voters who want to vote?
The number one responsibility falls on the municipality or voting precinct that where it is, and they are supposed to be looking at these things, because the Americans, this is not just the Help America Vote Act, this is also the Americans with Disabilities Act, which requires accessibility in all governmental services, and clearly voting is high on the list of governmental services. They have polling places. So this is not a new thing or a different thing. It's just something that we keep working on and working on. And there have been strides. I think there are a number of municipalities that said, "Whoa, we can't do this in that church basement anymore because of the steps. Let's move it over here to the elementary school that's all on one floor," or things like that. So there have been strides, and we also give out through GAB the certificates of compliance and for municipalities and voting districts that have come across as being 100% accessible.
And what kind of accountability is there for a polling place that might be found to be out of compliance?
Most of these things are worked on in collaboration with GAB to figure out how they can make this work. Clearly, if any individual has a problem, they always have a right, a cause of action. I don't want to get too legal on you, but because they can't restrict a service such as access to a polling place. Hopefully, short of that, though, the most of the county clerks and individuals interested in accessibility of their own particular polling place are more than willing to get started on making it accessible. The problem happens when you're in a situation that creates a really expensive alteration.
Now, we're about 15 months out from the next presidential election. What do you see as the biggest priorities for making sure that all voters are able to cast their votes in an accessible polling place?
I think that the number one issue to me is working on making sure that you have valid ID so that you can vote. Now, there are certain individuals who are considered to be in a confined facility, and there are some exceptions for that, but that's not the majority of people with disabilities. The majority of people with disabilities are out and about and members of the community, so they really need to make sure that they have that, either a passport or a driver's license, or they get going on getting that photo ID identification card, because sometimes it takes a couple tries before you get everything all lined up and all the forms filled out and get your card.
Kit, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Kit Kirschensteiner is an attorney with Disability Rights Wisconsin, where she heads their Help America Vote Act project. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. A small farm in northeastern Wisconsin is helping to preserve an important aspect of the Oneida tribe's culture. Besides providing organic produce, the farm grows white corn, beans, and squash in what's called a Three Sisters Garden. Patty Murray went to visit with the farm's director.
Jeff Matoxin directs the Junhequa Farm in Hobart, just west of Green Bay.
I'm saying Junhequa. When we share that with people, a phonetic spelling is J-O-O-N, June, H-E-Y, Hey, and then Q-W-A, Junhequa. A loose translation in the Oneida language is life sustenance.
It's an 80-acre spread that includes pastures for grass-fed beef and your garden variety vegetables like tomatoes and cucumbers. Those are used to make salsa and pickles that are sold at local stores. The star of the show is traditional white corn.
It's a heirloom corn, primarily used with our bread and our flours, our soup, a number of variety of products, well over 10 varieties.
Harvesting the corn and braiding the cobs is a hands-on process.
We do a hand harvest, and that event's called a harvest and husking bee. Usually takes about a week long. We invite everyone and anyone in the community to participate. We go through the steps of hand harvesting the corn. We'll talk about how to traditionally dry the corn, braiding
then it. Then comes the tricky part, drying it.
I'm just going to step in here and I'll turn this fan off, otherwise it's really long.
Matoxin steps into the crucial drying building on the Junhequa grounds.
The hooks that are up on top on the rafters is where we can put the braids up, so that's a traditional practice. So the hands-on process and traditions we want to make sure is kept alive and is part of our community. So we show them all these steps, but also we are using what's provided today. So technology, we do use a corn picker. It's not a combine system. It only picks the corn off the field from the stalk. It generally will husk for you, but we've got to dry it down. If we don't make sure we follow up on that properly, we can lose that crop because mold can spread so fast, a lot of pests and insects.
Matoxin says the purpose of the corn goes beyond human consumption. It's one of the three sisters alongside beans and squash.
The corn itself, it's one of our three sisters. Many of the tribal nations have corn, beans, and squash as that garden. And those varieties are so varied. So for the Oneida tribe, we have corn, beans, and squash as well of the three sisters. And what we always looked at as our food is that it's part of us. It's part of our responsibility. The three sisters and the corn itself is part of our creation story. We look at it as our relatives.
Junhequa doesn't aim to feed the tribe or even make much of a profit, though Matoxin says that would be nice. Instead, it's an educational model.
It's a never-ending learning process. We struggle with our mistakes, my problems, my issues, but then it's important to share that so that you can help someone when they look at, they don't have to grow an acre. They can grow so much from a potted plant or from small box gardens, raised bed gardens.
Junhequa's crop of traditional white corn will be ready for harvest in October.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org. Joining us now to talk more about this organic white corn is Jeff Matoxin, director of the Junhequa Program, a certified organic agricultural community and culturally based program of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So we find corn in so many of the foods we eat. How does this corn differ from common commercialized corn?
Well, one of the benefits that our program has been working hard for is it's a traditional corn that's always been part of our people and part of our community. So when we talk about our traditions and our culture, and especially talking about our relatives, the white corn, it's actually in our creation story. So we share that with the people. And what we've been finding out is as we study the corn as well as to learn more about it, one of the biggest benefits is from a health point of view, it's got a level of 17% protein, where a lot of times when you look at the corn that you're buying off the shelf, it may only have 3%, 4% protein provided for you.
Now let's talk a little bit more about the three sisters, the corns, the beans, and the squash. What is it about them that marry so well together and informs so much of history?
Again, one of the things that we've shared about is the three sisters' story. And what they end up doing is providing a symbiotic relationship with each other. So when the corn, as it's growing, it's providing you the trellis system that's needed for your pole beans. So once the beans are growing along with the corn, it just works its way up the corn stalks. And then with the squash that we use, one of the traditional squash is a Hubbard squash. It's actually very sturdy, can be very large. And it has such broad leaves on it when it grows, and it's got natural, most squashes have kind of a prickly vine that's growing. It provides a shade for the plants as they're growing. It provides a protection type of system so that any of the soft-petaled, not insects, but things you got to worry about, such as a raccoon, they don't like that. So they're not going to walk on it. So the three sisters as a whole, we share that story from the cultural standpoint, but we also generally work every year to have a Three Sisters model garden that we can show people why the corn, beans, and squash not only work together, grow together, help one another, but then provide you that great meal that can be used once the harvest time comes in.
Now, we hear a lot about heirloom seeds these days. Are you using special heirloom seeds for your Three Sisters garden?
Well, we're very fortunate that we've had a chance to work with some of the tribes in the New York area where the Oneida tribe's original homelands are. So when we made contact with them, we were talking about making sure we find the Oneida white corn that was used, that we ensure we pass it on to our people. So ever since that trip was taken, and this was before I started with the program, we've done the same seed selection with this corn since the mid-1990s. And so we want to ensure that we're passing on these same traits to our corn every year, but we share these traits also with our people and our community and those interested, what those steps are and how do you do your best to preserve an heirloom variety.
Now, it sounds as though you've got some farm-to-school efforts going on as well. Tell us about those.
We've got a really nice relationship, not only with the Oneida Tribal School, and one of the things, those who are really interested in the farm school program, you realize that unless you're this large, gigantic vegetable production, most industries or schools, you end up working with a number of growers. So we're one of the smaller growers that we can provide some kind of sustenance, especially more towards salad greens, to our tribal school. And it's something we've been working on for years and years. And we're very fortunate to have an excellent relationship, not only with some of the Green Bay schools, but the Ashwaubenon schools in our area, that together we are fortunate to become part of a live 54218 grant process and participate. And what we're doing is sharing what are the steps that we've learned that we've been still going through with the Farm to School program, and then how can we help one another. So it's always been part of an educational role we've played, I feel, with our community, with things we're doing. And I've mentioned before how you've got to be able to share the good stories, which everyone wants to hear, but also the challenges and the bad stories so that you learn from one another.
Can you tell us a little bit about the community of people who works on the Junhequa farm? Who are they? What is the range of ages? That kind of thing.
Well, actually, we're very fortunate to have the support of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. That's primarily where the budgeting comes from. And I did touch a little on the interview. I heard how we had talked about we are a program, we are education, we do want to share, but we've got to continuously strive for how to address the sustainability approach that we're looking for. So we have the employees that work for the program, but we also have a nice relationship that when people need to provide some hours, when they need to provide some community service, when they're looking to learn a bit about our program is so fortunate that for all that we're able to provide here, not just the white corn, but we wouldn't, I feel, exist in any way or be able to continue to grow and challenge ourselves if we didn't have the support of our community members. So it does range. We work with grade school levels, and we've gone way beyond the higher education to as well as with a number of elderly groups that not just do tours and presentations, but when they come on site, we really like and work hard to give them a hands-on demonstration, whether they're helping in the garden or the white corn, or especially with the cannery as well that we have as part of our program.
As you look down the road, what are some of your goals and aspirations for the Junhequa program?
I guess I would feel one of the big things that we'll always work for is looking through that sustainable practices that we're trying to find, because it's not necessarily based on the dollar, but it is a concentration on it. How can we recoup these expenses so that it's not just a drain in any way? And how do we make sure we don't lose this cultural value, traditional values and teachings, so that we continue to grow in our experiences, we continue to outreach towards not only the Oneida Tribal Schools, but the number of schools in our area. And we're very fortunate with our Harvest and Husking Bee, that's an annual event that we have so many schools involved with the education days. So it is kind of a goal to not only increase, but then making sure you're growing with it, not just to do more because you're capable of, but expand and use those learning experiences and share that with your people.
And what have you heard from people about what this means to them?
It's nice to be part of such a program that we've not only been able to have a nice communication with our community, and that's all the community members, both tribal and non-tribal, but then having that network ability that we've tried to reach out to a number of the tribal nations, not just in the state of Wisconsin, but also across the land, and then also working with a number of non-tribal entities and individuals. So it's ability to share with one another what we're learning. We'll target our traditional foods, the white corn, but we're constantly learning about organic gardening practices, constantly learning about grass-fed beef, poultry, and then food processing and preservation. And how do we help one another to do these things so that we can have a better lifestyle not only for ourselves but those future generations and sharing these steps and choices they have?
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Hopefully I helped a little bit what you're looking for and didn't take too much of your time.
Absolutely. Thank you. That was Jeff Metoxin, director for the Junhequa Program, a certified organic agricultural community and culturally based program of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. When you think of getting out and about in Milwaukee, you might think of the Art Museum, a Brewers game, maybe Summerfest. But our next guest says there's a whole lot more to Brew City, like exploring a medieval church or getting your hands dirty with urban farming. Jennifer Posh is the author of 100 Things to Do in Milwaukee Before You Die, and she joins us now. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, what's your number one all-time favorite thing to do in Milwaukee?
Oh man, that's a hard one. It depends really on what I'm looking to do. One of my favorite new things that I've done is actually going kayaking downtown.
Downtown?
You can actually kayak up the Milwaukee River that cuts right through the city and see all of the buildings from the river. And it was just such a fun new way to see the city. I'd actually never been kayaking before either. And it's really cool for a beginner. You can check it out and explore all of the rivers.
Do you need a guide to stay safe there, or is it okay if you just put your boat to water and set out?
Yeah, I went out with Milwaukee Kayak Company, so they kind of give you a map and give you a nice rundown on what you need to do, give you a crash course before you get in the water, and then you can kind of explore on your own. They also do guided paddles.
And so on a broader level, what is it about Milwaukee that you love and you think is special?
I think there's just such a wide variety of things to do here. Like, I'm obviously, you know, I'm kind of a younger professional, but I used to love coming down here as a kid when I was coming on school field trips, and there's so much things for families to do, and really people of all ages. I think Milwaukee has a little bit of everything, and I think a lot of people don't really realize what a diverse city it can be.
Now, in your Milwaukee bucket list, you divvy up the city into different groups. You've got food, entertainment, recreation, and history. And we're going to start with a Wisconsin favorite, the food. What do we need to know about living it up in Milwaukee when it comes to food?
Well, Milwaukee is obviously known as the Brew City. There's tons of great beer around here. There's tons of great cheese, but there's also so much more than that. There's award-winning restaurants, a really wide variety of cuisines. I'm personally a huge fan of the Milwaukee Public Market, where there's just so many local vendors there, and that's my favorite spot to bring people if we're going out for a meal, because everyone can get something from a different vendor, and everyone can really find something that they'd like there.
Can you describe the Milwaukee Public Market for us, for those of us who haven't been there?
Sure. It's very much in the style of like the big public market out in Seattle. It's an enclosed market. There's about 20 vendors down on the first floor that's open. There are prepared food vendors. There's also like a fish market, you know, cheese and bread that you can buy. And then up on the second floor is open dining area and some room to do classes. So you can buy your food downstairs and then go sit upstairs and eat or sit outside. There's a lot of picnic tables surrounding the market too.
And, of course, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the fish fry. So is Milwaukee a good hot spot for the fish fry?
Oh, definitely. It's hard to think of a place in Milwaukee that doesn't really have a fish fry. And there's still so many that I still want to try. I know Lakefront Brewery has a new one. and the fish market in the public market does fish fries, but also they have a lobster dinner that's really good.
Now, coffee is something a lot of people will travel far and wide for, and you suggest number 14 is get a local cup of Joe. So where should we go if we want a good local cup of coffee in Milwaukee?
Really anywhere. I love that there's so many local places around here. Pretty much any restaurant that you go to will serve coffee from a local roastery, too. I'm personally a big fan of Collectiva. I think that it's really good coffee, and their cafes are really fun and really vibrant. It's a cool place to hang out if you want to get some work done or, you know, hang out with a friend while you're having coffee and some pastries.
We're talking right now with Jennifer Posh. She's the author of 100 Things to Do in Milwaukee Before You Die. And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite thing to do in Milwaukee? Anything out of the way, a hidden secret that you'd like to let us in on? Call us at 800-642-1234. And we're going to move on to entertainment now, another one of your categories. Now, we know a bit about Summerfest, most of us, and the historic Pabst Theater. Those are a couple of the more marquee names. What else shouldn't we miss?
I think that you should definitely stop by local outdoor concerts. There's one almost every night during the summer out in the community parks. Those are obviously free. A lot of them are really family-friendly. They're a lot of fun to stop by. I'm a big fan of the Milwaukee Repertory Theater, which is just a really top-notch professional community theater here.
And what else is on your list? You've got, I see here, the State Fair.
Yeah, State Fair is coming up this week. It's just so much fun. I always go every year with my family. I'm personally a fan of the racing pigs. You can see the pigs race to catch their Oreo, and everyone's got to have a cream puff when they go.
Now, number 45 on your list is one that I discovered by accident, which is one of my favorites to do in Milwaukee now. See a movie at the Oriental Theater. Tell us what's special about that.
Oh, yeah. The Oriental is beautiful. It's one of the last real movie palaces that are remaining in Milwaukee. So it's super ornate. It's all done in, as you can probably guess, an Oriental style. They still have the pipe organ that functions. It hosts a lot of the major events for the Milwaukee Film Festival, and they just really get great movies, and it's such a fun experience to kind of see a movie in such an ornate, beautiful theater.
And how about learning about an American icon? Who are you thinking of there?
I'm thinking of Harley Davidson, founded in Milwaukee. The Harley Davidson Museum is located here. It's actually the only one in the whole world. And you can, you know, check out engine parts, set astride a Harley Davidson motorcycle. Right now they have a special exhibit that's honoring Willie G. Davidson, who is their lead designer emeritus, who is really responsible for a lot of the design that made Harley-Davidson motorcycles what they are today. And so in their special exhibit, you can see some of those bikes, and you can also see some of his personal watercolors and things from his collection, because he really is an artist and a designer.
We're going to take our first caller now at 800-642-1234. Alan is first in Whitefish Bay. Alan, hi.
Hi.
What is your favorite thing to do in Milwaukee?
This is Milwaukee's best-kept secret. It's called the Grohlman Art Museum.
The Grohlman Art Museum. Okay, what do we find there?
Aha, that tells me you never heard of it.
I have not. And okay. My grandparents are from Milwaukee.
No matter where they're from, anybody who gets exposed to this place is going to fall in love with it. I've been there 10 times. And I still can't wait to go back. The Grohlman Art Museum is part of the Milwaukee School of Engineering complex of buildings.
Uh-huh.
It's on the corner of Broadway and State in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And about a dozen years ago, an industrialist, formerly from Germany, who is a great art lover, came to Milwaukee. No, he came to Milwaukee a long time ago. 12 years ago, he had gone as far as he could go with his own art collection. It was probably, I'm guessing now, okay, this is just a guess. His own art collection, probably worth $20
million.
Wow. And Grohlman is a man of very substantial wealth. And he decided to collaborate. Grumman also is an engineer, hence the connection with the Milwaukee School of Engineering.
Okay, so what is it about the inside of it or the design that appeals to you?
It's stunning. It is absolutely stunning. It is modern. It is fascinating. The art collection is like nothing I've ever seen before in my life. The collection is stunning. The general theme for the whole place is men at work.
All right. So that sounds pretty fascinating. Stunning, men at work. It sounds like the design is something. And obviously this is something Alan is a big fan of. Jennifer, have you heard of that one, the Grolman Art Museum in Milwaukee?
Yeah, I have. I believe it is in the book. It is actually the largest collection of work of art that is dedicated to the evolution of human work in the whole world. And it really is a beautiful building. It's got, you know, really cool sculptures up on top. You can even see from the outside. And I definitely would recommend checking it out. It goes all the way from, like, farming and pastoral scenes up to art that's depicting the Industrial Revolution and kind of today's work.
And would you consider that one sort of an undiscovered gem?
Definitely. I mean, there are a ton of great museums in Milwaukee, and the Grumman is definitely kind of a secret gem that a lot of people don't realize is there.
Great. Great to hear about that one. Thanks so much, Alan. We're going to go next to Rachel in Alma. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
What is your suggestion?
A couple things. One is, if you're in Milwaukee and happen to be there during the beginning of the week, I would suggest to anyone who likes poetry that they should go to Linneman's River West End or Poets Monday in Milwaukee. It's an institution there, like 20-some years or better, that they've been having basically an open mic for local poets. And it's fantastic fun and very educational and interesting. It's always a good time.
And could you say the name of it once more, please, Rachel?
It's Linneman's River West.
Linneman's River West.
Yes.
Okay, got it.
You guys were talking earlier about a great place to get a cup of coffee, and it's a great place to get a cup of coffee and a sandwich if you want one. Everybody should see Fuel. Any one of the Fuel cafes are a fantastic place to get coffee in Milwaukee.
Terrific. Thank you so much for those, Rachel. Appreciate you sharing that. And Jennifer, do those ring any bells?
Yeah, I have a friend who's done who's read at Poetry Monday at Linneman's.
Excellent. Well, that sounds like a fun cultural experience to dive into that you might not get if you didn't know about it. Well, we're speaking right now with Jennifer Posh. She is the author of 100 Things to Do in Milwaukee Before You Die. And we'd love to hear from you on this. If you live in Milwaukee, if you're a regular visitor, what's your favorite thing to do there? Is there anything in particular you love that's maybe a little out of the way, maybe a secret? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our Milwaukee bucket list with Jennifer Posh. She's the author of 100 Things to Do in Milwaukee Before You Die. And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's on your Milwaukee bucket list? Anything that we've left out that is a must-do for you in Milwaukee? If you could only do three things in Milwaukee, what would they be? Call us at 800-642-1234. And we go now to Jenny. Jenny joins us from Milwaukee. Hi there.
Hi.
What do you vote for?
Well, this is kind of an unorthodox one, maybe, but it is quite a gem. At St. Luke's Hospital, they have a meditation garden at the top of the hospital on 27th and Oklahoma. And if people find themselves in the instance of being hospitalized or visiting a family member, I suggest checking it out.
What do you like about that garden?
It has the most gorgeous panoramic views of downtown, you know, from Miller Park all the way to the lakefront. And it's just well-appointed, and I don't know if enough people that are, you know, in the hospital realize that there's such a beautiful space to kind of take in the city and relax and get out of the medical world.
Oh, that's a great one, Jenny. Thank you so much for that, a hidden garden of Milwaukee. Jennifer, did you come across any others like that?
Well, I don't know if it's not quite in Milwaukee, but I'm a big fan of the Linden Sculpture Garden. They have beautiful monumental sculptures on their grounds. It's there are no paths there. You just kind of set yourself free and wander around and check out all of the beautiful sculptures. I'm a big fan of that one if you want to go kind of commune with art and nature.
And have you ever been up to that rooftop garden that Jenny just told us about?
No, that's a new one for me. That sounds like a really great resource for people at the hospital. I'll have to check out more about that.
Yeah, the view sounds incredible. Thanks a lot, Jenny, for that. And let's go next to Mackenzie in Oconomowoc. Hi there.
Hi. Something fun to do in Milwaukee is to go swing dancing. On Thursday night, it's at the Pabst Brewery, one of the bars in the Pabst Brewery complex. It's called Best Place. Every Thursday night, advanced classes start from 7:30 to 8:30, and then a beginner's class is from 8:30 to 9, and then there's open swing dancing from 9 to 12.
And is that every Thursday night?
Every Thursday night, and I believe this either the first or last Friday of every month, they have a live band as well.
Oh, that sounds fun. And so do people get dressed up?
Yeah. I usually wear like a, you know, flowy skirt. It's really fun. Also, it's through Cream City Swing. So if you go to creamcityswing.com, you can find out more information.
So just out of curiosity, who is it that shows up for these?
All sorts of people. I don't know. There's a wide demographic, young people, older people, people. I drive in from Oconomowoc. It's about a 50-minute drive, but it's definitely worth it. I've been going for a couple of years now.
Oh, that sounds super fun, Mackenzie. Thank you so much for telling us about that. I'd actually like to try that out. My husband and I do a little swing dancing at weddings, but it would be cool to do it in a setting like that. So, Jennifer, does that ring any other bells with what you've got on your list?
I'm actually super excited to hear about that because I'm a big swing dance fan myself. I knew about another spot for local swing dancing, but that's one I would have to check out. I do love Best Place at the Pabst Brewery, though. It's a really cool historic place, and the Brewhouse Inn and Suites up there, too, is also in one of the former Pabst Brewery buildings. I think I mentioned Jackson's Blue Ribbon Pub at the Brewhouse has excellent cheese curds, and I highly recommend stopping by for a plate and going to see the hotel because they still have the original brew kettles from when Pabst was brewing there in the atrium of the hotel, and you can stop in and see those.
Wow, that sounds great. What a nice mix of things. Mackenzie, appreciate that call. And we go next to Brennan in Green Bay as we talk about 100 things to do in Milwaukee before you die with our guest Jennifer Posh. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Brennan, hi. What is your thing to do in Milwaukee?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm actually not a resident of Milwaukee, but I have friends that live there, and I consider this the best-kept secret of Milwaukee. There's a place in Bayfield, and I'm sure the people listening in Milwaukee will probably know. It's called At Random, and it is one of the neatest bars I've ever seen in my life. It was constructed way back in maybe, I'm going to say, the 40s, and they haven't changed a thing. And it's dark, and the owners are old, and they love the company, and they're sweet people, can't swear, can't wear a hat, and they only serve, like, tropical drinks. There's no beer, no champagne, nothing like that. So you gotta, it's a one-drink minimum, and the decor and you know, the setting is such a throwback. But I've heard some news that they're going to tear it down, and I just want people to know that they should go and visit it because it's, like I said, it's the best-kept secret in Milwaukee.
Wow, fantastic. I can hear from your voice that is a cool place. Brennan, thank you so much for that. Jennifer, have you heard of At Random?
I have. I am actually a big fan of At Random. It wasn't in the book because, as he mentioned, there was some talk that maybe it would be closing, so I wasn't sure if it was still going to be around, but I've heard that it is. Kind of the other classic cocktail bar that I did include is Bryant's Cocktail Lounge, which has been open since 1937 or 38, and they have over 400 cocktails there, but no menu. You just talk to the bartender about what kind of things you like and what sort of feeling experience you want to have, and they pick out the perfect cocktail for you.
So any word on whether At Random is in fact going to be torn down?
The last I heard, it's still in operation, but... So hopefully they stay open for a long while still, because it really is an institution in the Bayview area.
Where is Bayview?
Bayview is a neighborhood just south of the city.
Okay, so a little south.
And that's actually where I live. I live in Bayview.
Got it. Well, appreciate that. And Brennan, thank you so much. We're talking again with Jennifer Posh, the author of 100 Things to Do in Milwaukee Before You Die. And we have an open line for you now with your suggestion, your favorite thing to do in the city. If you're willing to share that secret with us, we'd appreciate it. The number 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're going to go next to Lauren. Lauren is with us from Germantown. Hey, Lauren.
Hi. My favorite restaurant in Milwaukee is called Shahrazad. It's a really authentic Middle Eastern place on Oakland Avenue, right by the Oriental Theater. The lamb there is amazing. Like, any dish you get with lamb in it, I would recommend.
Okay, a restaurant recommendation. Those are always good. Lauren, thank you so much for that. And Jennifer, have you been there?
I have not. I'll have to put that on my list. I've always been looking for a new place to stop. You know, when you're going out for a movie, it's nice to have dinner beforehand.
Any other favorite restaurants you want to toss our way?
I'm a big fan of kind of the small plates trend is very big in Milwaukee right now. A lot of locally sourced ingredients and kind of small shareable plates. I really love Wolf Peach is one of my favorite restaurants, as well as Odd Duck, which is in Bayview, are both small plates restaurants that make just really excellent and really inventive dishes that are great to go out with a couple of friends and order a few plates, try a little bit of everything.
Is the dining scene in Milwaukee, is it localized or is it all spread out?
It's pretty spread out. You have kind of different pockets where there's a lot of different restaurants. But I would say that there's also a lot of those kind of really small niche places where you're walking down the street and you look over and see that there's a restaurant there that you maybe you didn't expect to be there.
Well, let's take a look away from food now. One of the things on your list, number 102, is visit a medieval church. Where do we do that in Milwaukee?
All right. You can visit the St. Joan of Arc Chapel. It's on the Marquette University campus. And it's a really, I've been there, it's very small and it's very beautiful. It's believed to be the oldest building in the Western Hemisphere still used for its original purpose.
Really?
It was. It was originally built in France, and it was brought over brick by brick and reassembled here in Milwaukee. And it's just really lovely, and they still do services there. And, you know, students and the public are welcome to attend those.
I've been trying to get there for a while. Isn't there some sort of legend about one of the stones on the chapel floor being a different temperature because purportedly Joan of Arc knelt on it?
Yeah, I have heard that. I haven't felt all of the stones, but I have heard that.
You didn't do that in your research? You didn't feel all the stones?
I know. I should have.
Well, what else are you going to leave us with that we can, if we want to go try some new stuff maybe, what else should we think about doing that's on your list?
The Milwaukee mural map is something that is kind of a cool experience if you want to explore the whole city. It's kind of a curated project where the creator has listed all of the different murals that are around the city. So that would be a great opportunity if you want to maybe take a bike tour or even just a walking tour to see some that are in the same neighborhood. My personal favorite Milwaukee mural is in the historic Third Ward, and it's one that says, choose a positive thought. And I see that every morning when I'm driving into work, and I really like to see it. It kind of brightens up the whole day, I think.
Nice. So there are some murals that are connected that you can maybe see a few of them if you're on bike or foot.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Great. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Jennifer, appreciate all these fresh ideas you gave us for Milwaukee.
Of course. I'm happy. I love to show friends around, and I hope that with this book I'm kind of, by proxy, showing everyone else around the city a little bit, too.
That was Jennifer Posh. She's the author of 100 Things to Do in Milwaukee Before You Die.